And so when he says that he wants to put his key into her ignition, what he's actually saying is he wants to put his penis into her vagina and turn it like he would turn the key into an ignition, hence Ignition the Remix. Was that not clear? I feel like that was, I feel like that subtext was hidden for a long time. It's a nuanced meaning that most people don't pick up on in that song.
There's no nuance there, my man. Like, none.
Now, usually I don't do this, but...
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Welcome to Junk Food Cinema, everybody, and the finale of our first film by prominent director series all January long, because January is long and now it is over, so we've arrived at the end, like most things do. But with today's director, the end isn't necessarily always at the end, and we'll get to that in just a moment. But first, I want to let you know that this is in fact Junk Food Cinema, which is the cult and exploitation film cast right here on Film School Rejects. We are celebrating the underappreciated, the unloved, and in today's case, both of those. Both of those actual things, appreciated and loved. But I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and I'm joined by my friend and co-host, novelist slash screenwriter, and Mr. Blonde himself. I guess in the color spectrum of my life, you would be Mr. Blonde, and that is C. Robert Cargill.
Yeah, I'm just now realizing that we're, you know, we
breaking all of our rules.
Well, yeah, but you know, it's I was just thinking, I was like, oh, it is January. Why didn't we do Tommy Lee Jones month? You know, why didn't we do January Jones? I don't understand. Why did we go with this beginnings thing? It's all of a sudden I'm questioning everything.
Hopefully we'll be around another year and we can do that
January Jones next year.
There you go. 2016. Put it on your calendar. Take a big drink. I mean, we play this drinking game a lot where whenever we talk about future episodes on a current episode, you take a drink. We're planning next year, apparently, and it's only fucking January, so we're way ahead of ourselves. Irresponsibly so, perhaps. But I want to remind you that this and all brilliant revelations like that can be heard on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow the show on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. Well, okay, so today we're going to give you the hard sell on a truly hidden gem, a film lost to the ages.
I don't think anybody's seen this or has heard from its director, and I don't know how.
That's the sad part. And, you know, this is a movie surely no one has told you about or even mentioned once at any point in your life. And that is a movie called, am I pronouncing this right? Reservoir Dogs?
Reservoir Dogs.
Reservoir, yes. Dogs. Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Podcasting in slow motion.
Or Res Dogs to you 90s hipsters.
Yeah, Cargill off mic said Res Dogs like 12 times in a single sentence, and I was like, is that really what we're doing? Is it Res Dogs? Okay. So this...
Look, the hipsters are not a new thing. They have been around for ages. I can cop to being one.
I was going
to
say.
Spending a large portion of my life as some sort of hipster. But yeah, the 90s hipsters, to those of us that had Quentin Tarantino posters on our wall, it was Res Dogs.
Res Dogs. Okay. All that being said, this is obviously Quentin Tarantino, this unheard of director and hasn't been heard of since. His breakout film from 1992. That made a huge splash at, I believe it was Sundance.
Yep.
Or Cannes? It was Sundance.
Sundance.
And
no,
really,
Pulp Fiction was the huge,
at Cannes.
That was the huge film at Cannes that won the Palme d'Or.
So this is Quentin Tarantino's first film. This is a film that not only launched his career, but as we're going to talk about later in the episode, really did start a revolution in independent filmmaking in the 1990s and came to be kind of the shot across the bow that led to this onslaught of really interesting stuff going on in the 90s in film altogether. But first, I guess we should talk a little bit about this movie that you've probably already seen,
yeah,
which is a rarity that I think, I'm going to guess probably 98% of the people listening to this show right now have seen Reservoir Dogs.
I think and then there's 2% that are like, oh shit, I've never actually watched Reservoir Dogs. It's one of those movies, and it's one of those movies that I assume has gotten to the point that's like Casablanca, that like Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction are one of those movies that people are like, well, I haven't actually seen it. Like I caught a little bit of it here and a little bit of it there, but you know, it's so ingrained in our culture that I feel like I've already seen it already, so I don't need to see it. Fucking see it. If you're like, if there's like one or two people out there that haven't watched Reservoir Dogs, holy God, are you missing out on a truly magnificent work that really redefined cinema. And you know, that's, and it's not overstating things. This movie changed the way Hollywood looked at making movies. It changed the way filmmakers looked at making their movies, and it spawned a host of imitators, knockoff artists, and inspired an entire generation of screenwriters. And it is a movie that just, to say that it was a shot across the bow, I think that's the best way to put it. It was just like, it's one of those things that just kind of came out. And it didn't make a huge splash when it first came out. You know, it was just a small indie film, but it started making waves, and it built up, and Res Dogs became one of those movies that you called Res Dogs and you passed it around to your buddies. And, you know, of like 8 VHS tapes that I owned back in the early 90s because I was poor and VHS was a lot more expensive than what we like to remember that it was. One of them was Reservoir Dogs, and it was constantly on loan. And there's a period of time in my life where I would wake up in my apartment and friends would be over and my roommate would be watching it with friends. And I would know exactly what point of the movie it is by which monologue is going on at the time, and then walk out and be able to, you know, say whatever the next line was. Because it was that kind of a movie. And it's weird. The thing about this movie that it had such a profound effect on me was it was the first film that I watched that I didn't like the first time I watched.
Really?
And it not that it was the first movie I didn't like, but it was the first movie that I didn't like that started nagging me the next day and the next day and the next day. And by less than a week later, I was like, I need to watch that movie again. You know, I don't think there's anything wrong with that movie. I think there was something wrong with me. And I sat down and watched it again. I was like, holy God, this movie's great. It's the first time you watch through it and you get to that ending, you know, where almost all the characters die in this profoundly just dark.
Spoiler alert for the 2% of you who haven't seen the movie.
I said almost. I mean, the thing is, you don't know who's going to live. And in fact, for a long time, there was a big argument as to whether anyone lived at all. Hmm. And that was a big debate for a long time. And I remember going over to a friend's house and somebody had gotten it on Laserdisc, and he had these particularly, he had a great,
that's the sexiest sentence I've ever heard.
And he had this really great speaker set up. And so he tweaked the levels so he could actually hear what was going on with the police outside and actually hear all the dialogue so we could find out if that character lived or died at the end. And because that for the longest time, that was the big argument you'd have in coffee shops. It's like, yeah, no, everybody dies in Reservoir Dogs. It's like, no, they don't. He gets out. And it's like, no, he doesn't. You hear the gunfire. It's like, no. He totally gets out. He gets away. And it was kind of like, it was almost like a Pan's Labyrinth of sorts, where it told you who the, you know, who the fantasists and who the cynical bastards were. Like the cynical bastards were like, no, everybody dies. It's just everybody's gone. And then, you know, the fantasists were like, no, I want to believe that someone lives, that someone got away with the diamonds. You know, somebody has to. And you know, and the thing about it is it's such a simple movie. It's, but what was brilliant about it was Tarantino gave us what we generally don't see in films. He said, you know what? You know, most heist movies are about the, you know, the days leading up to it, and then the climax is the heist, and maybe we get a little afterwards. He starts after the heist is over, and all the fucked up shit is happening, and everybody's trying to figure out what's fucked up about it. And we never actually see the heist. We get little hints of the heist, but we never see the heist, and it's all about everyone trying to figure out what went wrong.
It is an experiment in aftermath. I mean, we see things leading up to the actual heist. We see the complete and utter fallout of the heist, but we never see the heist itself. And I think that was a really bold choice. When you make a heist movie where the heist is irrelevant. The heist is not the important thing here. What's important is what happens when your best laid plans go completely awry and how things start to unravel because of it. And then it's like, now that you've known that it's gone awry, how did we get to this point? Who are these people? And then we start to meet the players involved and how they all got there. And I want to talk a little bit as we go along. I'm just going to start throwing these out here because Quentin Tarantino, I mean, this probably as much as, let me think about this, as much as Thief. We talked about Thief being a film where a director comes right out of the gate and announces to you everything about their style that would define them as a filmmaker going forward. Very much the situation here with Reservoir Dogs again. Everything you need to know about Quentin Tarantino is in this first movie. Everything that will come to be Quentin Tarantino's style is evident and visible in this first movie. And one of those things is that Quentin Tarantino is, he's not an academic filmmaker. He is a fan. He's a film geek like the rest of us.
Yeah.
He's a guy that just completely absorbed any and all celluloid he could get his hands on, watched, you know, hours and hours of videotapes, worked at a video store like a lot of us did,
yep,
and found a way to turn his love of film into his filmmaking process. Found a way to, and a lot of people have accused Quentin Tarantino of just ripping everybody off. That's all he does, is he rips other people off. But the thing is, I've seen movies where filmmakers are just ripping other people off, and the movies are pulseless. They're just completely dead.
Well, it's one of the things that Harry Knowles used to talk about when this would come up, was that, you know, he'd be like, yeah, the thing about Tarantino is Tarantino steals, but Tarantino acknowledges that he steals, and Tarantino steals better than anyone else steals. He takes stuff and he gives us back a product that is better. And, having gone to a couple of his festivals back in the day, he used to come to Austin and have QT fests.
I went to one of those as well. Yep.
And he would, for, you know, 7 to 10 days, he would just show movies, and he would do it before he would go off to make another movie often. And that's one of them that I went to, I went to the one right before he made Kill Bill, and he openly admitted at the beginning, hey, look, I'm doing research for Kill Bill, and these are a bunch of movies that I am, you know, borrowing elements from for Kill Bill, and I really want to see your reactions to this, so don't be afraid to react to these movies. This is, you know, I want to see how this stuff plays, because, I'm totally going to take some of this stuff. And that's just who he was. But the thing is every movie that he takes from, you know, ends up, all but one, end up being a great movie.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is that not only does he acknowledge it, but he finds a way to turn homage into signature. He finds a way to make the things he's borrowing from, the pastiche that he creates is wholly his own. No matter how many things he borrows from at once, when he throws them all in the Cuisinart, that recipe culminates into a dish that is wholly his own. And one of the things that he does really well is he writes dialogue. And he writes dialogue that appears to be about nothing at all. He writes dialogue that seems completely irrelevant to the events of the plot. He writes the kind of discussions, the kind of chats that, you know, he was probably having with his friends, you know, and somehow his character, one or two of his characters, end up with the same sort of pop culture obsession that he himself has. And I think that's one of the great things, is that this movie opens. This is so much a statement about who he is as a filmmaker, that the first line of the first movie he ever made is spoken by Mr. Brown, talking about the true meaning of Madonna's Like a Virgin. I mean, right there, like, you want to talk about a director establishing his own voice, it literally comes from his own voice.
Yeah.
Like, that's really remarkable. And then they have this conversation around a table that is clearly a bunch of guys who are about to start some shit. Like, they're all dressed the same, they've got these really sharp, sleek suits. They're, you know, the way they talk to each other, you kind of get a sense that they've either been in prison or they're all, you know, bad guys to some degree. And they're talking about Madonna. And they're talking about, you know, they go off from, you know, Quentin starting talking about this is what Like a Virgin's about to, oh, this is what I liked Madonna. I don't like that song. I like that. So it's like everybody's obsessed with the same pop culture stuff that he is in his movies. And the way that those discussions never take away from the story but add to it is really impressive. Because in the hands of a less able filmmaker, that could really get in the way. That could really slow things down.
Well, and it has. I mean, that's the thing. And we'll go into that more when we talk about, you know, what he did to screenwriting and the Imitators that followed. But yeah, it is something that he gets away with. Because it's what he's really good at it. And when he wants to have characters bullshit, we go along with him because he never wastes our time with it. Which is why for several years after these movies, he was brought in as a script doctor to come in and help repair films. In fact, he wrote a couple of scenes in one of our favorite films, Crimson Tide.
Yes.
And you can tell which ones are Tarantino's.
Oh, I don't know. Maybe the one about the Silver Surfer
and Scooby Doo, and you know, yeah, no, there's a whole host of moments that you're just like, oh yeah, that's the Tarantino dialogue, and it's of course talking about the best submarine movies, and yeah, but he came into they needed to humanize these characters, they needed to give them some character, and they're like, let's bring that Tarantino guy in. Because, you know, at the time, you know, there's a Tony Scott movie, and Tony Scott would go on to make one of his scripts, which he had read and was in love with, and was like, oh, let's bring in Quentin and have Quentin do some work on this. And Quentin was Quentin, and then he did some rewrite work on It's Pat, because everybody has to have one of those in your career.
I'm sorry, that still baffles me a little bit.
It baffles everybody.
But it like, happened.
Yeah.
It happened. Yeah, so like I said, the opening shot of the movie is him having this discussion, and then from there you go into this really elaborate patchwork of homages and reference to other films. The fact that none of the heistmen know each other is borrowed from two sources. One is Stanley Kubrick's The Killing, which to this day is my favorite Stanley Kubrick film. And the other is The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3.
Where he even steals the whole name.
Mr. Blue, Mr. Yeah, like literally, like lifted right out of that. And then like everything, not everything, but a lot of the stuff you see from that point forward, you could literally set a clip of another film or, you know, a TV show right up against it and see where it came from.
And this the entire film comes from
City on Fire.
Yes.
Yeah, which is a Ringo Lam movie that for years, there was an interview where he was asked about City on Fire because the two films, this is not like they have a passing similarity or this element and this element are the same. The entire fucking movie is structured. There are entire scenes lifted from a Ringo Lam film from the late 80s called City on Fire. Now, when initially asked about this, Tarantino said, no, I've never seen that movie. And then it wasn't until much, much later that he admitted in a separate interview, oh yeah, I totally saw that movie. So it, you know, I think that might be for some people why he got this reputation of just being a plagiarist, which I think is a really unfortunate classification to assign to him, because I think he really does turn homage into signature. He finds a way to reference the movies that he loves, much in the same way Cargill and I are sitting here right now just gushing about all these movies that we love. He takes that and he finds a way to turn it into an art form. He finds a way to make it wholly his own, even as he is standing on the shoulders of giants.
Well, and I've talked to people who have gone and gone to a couple of like seminar showings with Scorsese and Scorsese's editor, and apparently Scorsese is a big plagiarist. He's one of those guys that instead of stealing story elements, what he does is he steals shots, and he'll go back to some shot from this film in 1926. And he's like, I want this shot to look exactly like this.
Yeah.
And we're going to shoot it like this and frame it like this. And it, you know, people generally don't recognize it. But then when you show those clips together with the movies, you're like, holy shit. Like that brilliant Scorsese shot is actually, but the thing is that he does it in a way that it becomes art form.
Well, that's the thing is every great filmmaker has been influenced by great filmmakers. That's the way art is in general. That's the way film is especially, because it's both a visual, auditory. I mean, it is a medium that appeals to almost all the senses. And first of all, we've talked about Halloween being a complete and total ripoff of Black Christmas, ripping off Touch of Evil. Like every great filmmaker is influenced, and every great filmmaker's influences end up in their own work. That's just the way it works.
And there's the great old maxim, you know, good writers borrow, great writers steal. and there's, you know, you go back and there's a lot of truth to it. There's a lot of truth to it.
Now, we don't need to go into too much of this plot, I don't think. I don't think we need to talk too much about what it is that makes this movie great, because you guys already know this.
And if you don't, holy God, do you need to fucking watch Reservoir Dogs right the fuck now. Like, do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Do not consider yourself a film geek until you watch Reservoir Dogs, for fuck's sake.
Yeah, I would have to agree with that very emphatically. But here's a couple things that I want to talk about, how low budget, just how independent this film really was. Because Quentin Tarantino had so little money to make this movie when he first started out that he was going to shoot it in his basement, where he and his friends, including his longtime producing partner,
Lawrence Bender,
was going to play one of the roles. That's all they had. They had
Lawrence Bender, who you'll recognize as the long-haired guy in the coffee shop in Pulp Fiction.
Yes. Craziness. So that's originally what the movie was going to be. It was literally going to be a movie shot in his basement with his friends. Enter the White Knight, Mr. White himself, Harvey Keitel. Harvey Keitel gets a hold of the script through the most random connections. Basically, Harvey Keitel was friends with the wife of an acting teacher. Like, it's the most insane, like, happenstance that you could possibly imagine. But he gets a hold of the script, and he likes it so much that he calls up Quentin Tarantino, and apparently for a long time, Quentin had this answering machine message saved. I'm Harvey Keitel. Not only would I like to play one of the roles, but I'm going to put up money to produce this movie. And suddenly they have a $1.5 million movie and everything changes. And the whole history of Quentin Tarantino and independent cinema in the 90s could be boiled down to one benefactor, yeah. Harvey fucking Keitel.
Who got the script by chance or by hook or by crook in some weird way.
Yeah. So even as they're shooting it, though, there's things like they couldn't afford things like traffic assistance in L.A. So, for example, the scene where Steve Buscemi pulls the woman out of the car, when he first drives away, they had to do that when the light was red because they couldn't pay the money to get the traffic lights switched or to get the roads blocked off. So they literally just like, okay, red light, go, shoot the scene, and then get off. Like, it's as guerrilla as the actual robbery in the movie. Yeah. It's just happening while the streets are fully functioning, while people are everywhere. That's pretty fantastic to me. Like, this is the definition of an independent film.
Yeah, well, no, he famously was sleeping on a friend's couch while he was writing the script.
Yeah. The people in the movie, the guys in the movies, had to bring a lot of their own clothes. The only reason they had the suits is because the designer donated them. If you look at Steve Buscemi, he's the only character in the movie not wearing suit pants. It's just wearing black jeans that are his. Chris Penn's nice guy Eddie tracksuit is actually Chris Penn's, which is not hard to believe.
Yeah, but that makes it kind of awesome.
And then this is my favorite thing that I didn't know until I was researching this. But when Mr. Blonde, played by Michael Madsen in the era when Michael Madsen was the king of cool, when he first comes into that warehouse, he's got that fast food drink. Apparently, he got that from a Taco Bell drive-thru. And he went through that Taco Bell drive-thru with the actor who played the cop in the trunk of the car. Because the actor who played the cop was like, no, I want to, you know, like, actually put me in the trunk. Like, don't be afraid. I'm an actor, but just throw me in the trunk. Let's have it be more realistic. And Michael Madsen's like, okay. So not only did he put him in the trunk, then he started driving around like bumpy roads just to fuck with the guy. And went through a drive-thru in Taco Bell with a guy in his trunk. I love that story. That is fucking fantastic.
And so they put the drink in the film.
Yeah. So he's still got it when he walks in.
Cause that's the type of thing where it's just like, oh yeah, of course. Of course, Mr. Blonde not only has someone in his trunk, but he's such a cool cat. He goes through the fucking drive through.
And then of course there's the famous James Woods story about Reservoir Dogs, where James Woods, Tarantino pitched him several times as several different characters in the movie. And every time he was told by James Woods' agent, he's not interested. Wasn't until years later, James Woods even found out that he had been offered any of the roles in this movie and was so pissed off that he fired his agent. He's like, you really kept me from being in Reservoir Dogs, you fucking asshole, and fired him. James Woods could have been one of the robbers in this movie.
Probably. He probably would have been Mr. Blonde.
Yep. Yeah, more than likely would have been Mr. Blonde. But yeah, so I mean, just so many great stories about like a filmmaker who no one has taken seriously yet, having to, you know, like, I think By Hook or By Crook is the perfect phrase for this entire filmmaking process.
He would have been Mr. Brown and Tarantino wouldn't have been in it.
Ah, that's also possible. That's also entirely possible. Dude, James Woods giving that speech about
the Madonna speech,
how Like a Virgin's about taking a big dick.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, years later, Madonna signed a copy of Like a Virgin to Tarantino and it said, "Dear Quentin, it's about love, not about dick." Madonna. She was apparently a really big fan of the movie and of that conversation. But yeah, I mean, this is the original, like I said, the original budget was around $30,000. Keitel gets involved. It goes up to $1.5 million. He's able to make the movie that he wants with nobody telling him what to do. And the result is something unlike anything we had seen before, even as he's showing us things that in pieces had existed out there in the litany of films, but that he was able to make totally his own. And as we're about to talk about, changed the way films were made from that point forward in a lot of ways.
So this premiered, I want to say, in 92, at Sundance 92, alongside another little film called El Mariachi. And this movie, this particular Sundance is really, it lit the fuse on what would become cinema in the 90s. You know, at this point, you know, we talk a lot about cinema of the 70s and of the early 80s, and occasionally we straggle into the late 80s, but we don't often spend much time in the late 80s, early 90s. And that's because at this period, cinema was really lost. Hollywood had no idea where, you know, where they were going. You know, there had been all these profound movements. You know, in the early 70s, you have all these, this explosion of young filmmakers coming out of film school and making all this exciting stuff. And then in the mid 70s, we ushered in the blockbuster era while the grindhouse era is going on. And then we have this big push of big budget genre blockbuster movies that carry us through the early 80s. And then we hit the wall in 1986, where all of a sudden we have all these big budget genre flops and Hollywood's like, we're not into genre anymore. Let's find out what the new thing is. And they start grasping at straws. And it works every once in a while. You get some good stuff. Some interesting stuff comes along. We get a couple of great genre gems out of that era, you know, Terminator 2, Total Recall, RoboCop. You get through, but you really feel Hollywood running out of steam in 90, 92. Like they just don't know. Like horror has spun itself out and has just become a shadow of itself. And nobody can make money off genre films anymore unless it's an established franchise, or has Arnold Schwarzenegger in it. You know, people are trying, but stuff just isn't working. You get some cool outliers. You know, you get stuff like Evil Dead and, you know, the Army of Darkness. You know, you get weird, campy stuff like Robot Jocks, you know, that's super low budget. But nothing, you know, nothing's really catching. And then all of a sudden, a whole mess of voices show up at Sundance all at once and just change everything. And all of a sudden, the names on everyone's lips in Hollywood are Quentin Tarantino, Robert Rodriguez, Spike Lee, and blanking on his name all of a sudden because I do that. Clerks.
Kevin Smith.
Kevin Smith. Yeah. Like, you know, all these guys make all these super low budget movies and they're captivating audiences and making really interesting stuff. And all of a sudden, everyone's like, what the fuck is this? And they're like, well, let's give them money and see what they can do. And so they start giving these guys money and they start making all these interesting things. So all of a sudden the studios now are sending tons of people out, what became known as PIBs, the people in black, who would go to Sundance and just be looking for films. And so Sundance became the way for young unknown filmmakers to make their splash. And so all of a sudden now you've got the likes of Paul Thomas Anderson showing up and you've got all these really interesting voices just coming out of the woodwork, all because of what happened with Res Dogs, El Mariachi, and Clerks. And all of a sudden Hollywood started following suit.
Mm-hmm.
And what this had a couple of effects. One of the big effects was on screenwriting, and all of a sudden everybody realized that you could have personable, down-to-earth characters that referenced modern culture in a way that we all reference modern culture. That you could have two guys sitting in a car and one of them's just come back from Europe and he's going on and on about all the differences between Europe and the United States, where it can be interesting to talk about, you know, what they call a quarter pounder with cheese in France and Amsterdam and you know, what they put on their French fries. And that you could develop characters that way. And it led to things that were both good and bad. The good side is we got a push towards interesting realism and people accepted the fact that you could have a naturalistic conversation in a movie that felt like something that was really going on in your living room or your kitchen or just down the street. On the bad side, it created a lot of really cheesy self-referential, you know, dialogue in which, you know, it was movies talking about movies, talking about movies. And it became, and there was a lot of bad writing that came out of that era as well.
Yeah. And I'm sorry. I was just thinking about like all of these weird little nuances, like the colors that he uses apparently are very indicative of what's like, there's. Like in the scene where everybody's, I wouldn't say being introduced to each other because they're not really being introduced to one another, but like there's like things in the room and during that scene that'll later play into, like there's an orange rag back on the ramp, which is where Mr. Orange will be laying. There's like a white and pink shirt in the background hanging there, and that's where Mr. Pink and Mr. White like are pointing guns at each other. Like, I didn't realize this, but like even in the scene where they're discussing who's alive and who's dead, the only thing in the room is a yellow sink, which means Mr. Blonde is still alive. I never noticed those things before. That's really, really fascinating.
It's a little strange. And the question is how much of that was intentional and how much of that is just...
I don't know. Like, I think an orange rag, pink and white shirts are odd things to have in a mortuary, which is where that warehouse... What that warehouse actually was.
I know for years people wanted to, you know, people talked about the orange balloon that flew behind the car during, you know, one of the shots. And what that meant, and that it was actually Tarantino's clue that Mr. Orange was the cop. And then later Tarantino's like, no, it just kind of popped into the shot. And that could very well be. We thought it was cool and we kept it.
I mean, and that's very much like the briefcase in Pulp Fiction. Everybody assumes is this, whatever. I think there's certain things you can deride. And I think there's certain things that are just way too coincidental.
But you guys are like making me lose my train of thought here. I was saying something. What was it?
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to rail the discussion.
No, that's okay. There. No. It's all good. That's no. There's a lot of stuff about deconstructing Tarantino that's interesting because Tarantino does some crazy shit sometimes, and he has some very subtle things in his movies, and then sometimes things just happened and people were reading into it because he was in the 90s. He was the messiah of modern screenwriters. You know, I was taking film classes at the time, when this happened, and the weekend Pulp Fiction came out, it was like an atomic bomb went off. Like it changed everything. Like the weekend after, I remember being in film class and all of a sudden everybody was shooting hitman movies and everybody was writing, you know, pithy dialogue and everybody was setting everything in coffee shops and like I swear to God, somewhere there's a stack of 8mm reels of stuff that I shot that's exactly fucking like that because we all did it. Like, I'm not going to point fingers and go, yeah, everybody was, no, we were all ripping off Tarantino at the time because it was just this new explosive thing, and it crossed our reality with genre films, and that was something we had not seen in a while. It was something, you know, Hollywood had gotten very slick and blockbusters had kind of become the rule of the day, and all of a sudden give a voice to these unknown young people who are talking about this world that we're living in where, you know, every movie is smoking cigarettes in a diner. And it's like, that's what I do in my time off. You know, I'm always hanging out at gym and drinking black coffee and smoking cigarettes. This is my life, except with black suits and guns. This is awesome. And it was just, it was so surreal to watch. And so it spawned a lot of imitation in terms of screenwriting. And then it also spawned the knockoffs. And that's where we started seeing these knockoff Tarantino-esque crime movies, including one that Tarantino was in, and they pushed very heavily that Tarantino was in it, but he didn't write it or direct it, and it wasn't his movie. Destiny Turns on the Radio.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. That movie that it just everybody out there went, wait, what is he? Oh, shit, yes, that is not a good movie. yeah, and in this era, the fact that he was in it, dude, the theater was packed with young hipsters that were just like, it's a Tarantino movie, it's new Tarantino. And then we walked out going, well, at least he didn't write it or direct it. You know, he's in it, but maybe it was his friend's movie. I don't know. Like, we were making excuses for him, and it was, yeah, no, but it was a weird era. But you get the knockoffs, like you get stuff like some cool, interesting stuff, both successes and failures, like 2 Days in the Valley.
Yeah, and Go is another one.
Oh yeah, no, John August definitely. That was the movie that broke him. That he borrowed the structure from Pulp Fiction and did it brilliantly. Yeah, no, it's. He had so much influence on the that era. You know, you get like there's the good knockoff films, and then there's a lot of crap. Like one of my favorites that I tortured you with once that I don't understand why I love it, but I just kind of do. Albert Pune's Mean Guns.
Oh fuck you, yeah,
and you didn't. Don't say fuck. You never even got to me. We got like 15 minutes in.
Yeah, because I couldn't take it anymore.
It's kind of gloriously awful in all the best ways. Like I just enjoy that stupid movie.
I think my favorite knockoff of the Tarantino era was Troy Duffy's Boondock Saints, which
Duffy still claims to this day that he had not seen Reservoir Dogs or Pulp Fiction before he wrote that script.
And Tarantino never saw City on Fire either. Yeah. So
well, and that was the thing is. Troy Duffy's career was launched as a result of this big search. Mm-hmm. You know, the Weinsteins after this happened were like snapping up talent, and it became a weird era where studios were starting, you know, becoming like real talent scouts and looking for these young stars. And they were looking, you know, it was almost like they were going to, it was like the football scouts going to high schools, trying to draft people right out of high school. And, there was a script that went around for Boondock Saints and the Weinsteins were so in love with it. And they're like, oh, this is our next big hit. This is great. This is the new Tarantino. And they were so happy. They not only bought the script and paid Duffy, who had never directed anything before, to direct it, but then also bought him the bar that he was working at as a signing bonus, as a gift. and that led to most of the story that you see in Overnight about him. But that's what this era was. Like, everybody was looking for the next big thing. And there are a couple people that came and, like, got their brief shot. You got like your Allison Anders, who, you know, was this up and coming director, and then never quite hit. And we had this really interesting era where all of a sudden, independent films were playing alongside mainstream films. They weren't just at the art houses anymore. The mainstream theaters were carrying. Oh, actually, I disagree with you. You know what the best Tarantino knockoff of all time is?
I just said my favorite, but yeah,
The Usual Suspects.
Oh. Yeah, because it's out of sequence. Okay, yeah, I can get behind that.
Yeah, that's...
Yeah, I never claimed Boondock Saints was the best.
No.
It's my favorite.
No, yeah, no. I love... Believe me, I love the shit out of Boondock Saints. But we had all these films that all of a sudden were getting a big shot. And this is where you also see, you know, this because... Indie films are the new big thing. It allowed people like some of our favorites, like as we've talked about, like John Sayles, to go outside, and not have to make mainstream stuff anymore, you know, not having to make the Oscar films anymore, and go outside of that to make his personal films like Lone Star, where all of a sudden directors were able to have a voice, and directors became kind of front and center again.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just guys who, you know, were making big expensive blockbusters. All of a sudden the names on everyone's lips were these guys making these low budget personal films.
Yeah.
And it was a fascinating era, and it was, and eventually it spun itself out as, we got to the end of the 90s and every director on the planet was following in the footsteps of these guys and charging their movies onto their credit cards and going $30,000 in debt and showing up to Austin Film Festival and hoping the Weinsteins would discover them.
And you got to give credit to Tarantino, who, even while he's making Reservoir Dogs, his first film ever, holds his ground against Harvey Weinstein. Like, I can imagine Harvey Weinstein is an intimidating figure for even established filmmakers, but for somebody right out of the gate, Weinstein didn't like the torture scene. He thought it was too much, thought audiences would tune out, didn't want it in the movie. Tarantino's like, no, it absolutely has to be, stood his ground, and Weinstein actually relented.
Well, and they've had a great relationship. Like, they get along really well. And the thing is that Weinstein listens to Tarantino, and Tarantino knows how to make his case. And Weinstein gambled on him, and Tarantino was right. And so from that point on, he gives Quentin a lot of leeway. It was really interesting. I was at they did the test screening. They did one test screening for Kill Bill Volume 2, and they did it here in Austin. And the local critics all found out about it, you know, the local set. And so, like, the theater was just full of the who's who of the Austin, you know, movie scene, you know, filmmakers and film critics and film buffs. And we're just all there, and it's Tarantino and the Weinstein brothers. And it was really interesting because I walked out of the theater just as Harvey, I was right behind Harvey Weinstein. And the people, NRG, I believe is who it was, who was there, the, you know, the polling, the research people who test the movies, go to hand him and me, our forms, to fill out. And he just waves. He goes, we're not going to need that. Movie's great. And it played. And like they had this big, flown all these people down here for it. And all Harvey Weinstein had to do was watch how it played to an audience. And nope, don't, but that was all the testing we needed. That's how much faith he has in Quentin. That was the extent. But that was built on, this relationship of Quentin putting out movie after movie that, even if they weren't big blockbusters like Pulp Fiction was, which Pulp Fiction was the first indie film to cross $100 million. Even if they weren't blockbusters, they were all critically acclaimed and kept the prestige of Miramax going at the time. So he stood his ground against Weinstein and earned Weinstein's respect after that fact.
Yeah. And I think it's great too that, you know, some of the biggest movies of the 90s in some way all have Tarantino's fingerprints on them. I mean, we obviously with Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, but you also think about True Romance, which is a script that he wrote, that Tony Scott directed.
Which was one of the two movies that was supposed to be his first movie. Yeah. And then
the other one, the script that he was writing with Robert Rodriguez for a movie called From Dusk Till Dawn.
Yep.
And how elements of that script end up in both Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, if not Pulp Fiction for sure. And he kept borrowing and doing this and that with that script to the point that Robert Rodriguez is like, well, I guess I got to make this movie because the carcass keeps getting picked clean.
Yeah.
And I will make it with what's left. And then, of course, Natural Born Killers.
Yeah. And Natural Born Killers and True Romance were both supposed to be his first films. And then he got Reservoir Dogs off the ground, and then he was offered the chance to direct those, and he's like, no, I don't want to do them. Those were my first movies. They're not my first movies anymore. And so Tony Scott ended up doing True Romance, which is fucking brilliant.
Yes, it is.
And Oliver Stone ended up doing Natural Born Killers, which I still contend is fucking brilliant. So some people argue that fact. It's one of those highly debated ones. You're giving me that look.
I hate that fucking movie
so much.
I love that movie so much. Not a fan of Natural Born Killers.
Oh, I love Natural. I saw that movie 3 times in a theater. And I love the hell out of Natural Born Killers. But the thing is looking at it though, it's understandable why you'd hate it. It's certainly not a Tarantino movie because Oliver Stone butchered that script.
No, my problem with it is not that it's not a Tarantino movie. My problem with it is that it doesn't even function like a movie so much as like drug addled fever dream. If that's the style he wants to go for, great. I just don't find that very, I don't know. It is not engaging for me at all, but that's neither here nor there.
But so those movies that were Tarantino movies were part of this big Tarantino revolution. Like, we had a period of time there where, you know, a lot of people hadn't seen Reservoir Dogs until they saw Pulp Fiction. They heard all the buzz on Pulp Fiction, went and saw it, said, oh my God, that movie's so great. Oh, I got to see whatever else this guy's done. Oh, then they saw Reservoir Dogs, and then, oh, True Romance, what's this? And oh, Natural Born Killers. And then all of a sudden you've got Tarantino on the Tonight Show. Mm-hmm.
allegedly.
No. He sniffled on the Tonight Show, and
what we're alleging is that the reason for that may also have something to do with his frantic style that he sometimes
there was that discussion on. At my house where people were like, wait, did that just no that didn't just happen, yeah, no, and turned into a heated argument.
And after meeting him in person, seems a lot more likely that the sniffle was not the cold. Speaking of, I'm going to talk about it anyway. There's always this great thing about
speaking of segues,
about the Tarantino universe, the Tarantino verse, and how there's these little elements in all of his movies that, kind of connect them all, kind of suggest that they all take place in the same universe. One of my absolute favorite ones is, one of the big ones is that Mr. Blonde's real name is Vic Vega, and he is supposedly the brother of Vincent Vega, John Travolta's character from Pulp Fiction. But my favorite one is that Steve Buscemi appears as a waiter in Pulp Fiction after giving this diatribe in Reservoir Dogs about how he doesn't tip waiters.
Yeah.
To me, that was like, I like to imagine that Mr. Pink got away with the diamonds, fell in hard times, and then is this sort of comeuppance from the universe, was forced to work as a waiter for a while, laying low while he's committed some other crime.
Mr. Pink doesn't get away.
Mr. Pink doesn't get away, apparently. I think he does, but...
No. If you listen very closely to that underlying, he doesn't die, but the cops get him. Like, he gets nabbed by the cops.
I don't know. But this overarching universe thing is really interesting, because we've talked about how the ascension of Quentin Tarantino was sort of a reaction to studio systems, Hollywood moving away from genre, and audiences kind of getting sick of genre. But I feel like there's something kind of full circle about the fact that universe building is now the chief tool of the biggest studio on the planet. Like, Marvel's movies are all about building universes and connecting this. And they've gotten to the point where some of the things they don't even state. It's just little things here, little things there. And Tarantino was never overtly saying this is connected to that or this. You just kind of had to listen, because he'd like to operate in the same world.
You've got Alabama, in True Romance. And then you've got, you know, Mr. White talking about hooking up with a girl named Alabama and that she's a good little thief, things like that. But Tarantino's actually talked about this, and he's talked about the fact that there are two different universes that he plays with, and that there's the Tarantino-verse, which is this universe of Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs and Jackie Brown. And then there's the cinema universe, where it's everything is very cinematic, and it is very rooted in the fact that it is a movie, and that's your Kill Bill and your Inglourious Bastards, your movies that only function as movies. They don't function as reality.
Right.
And this is where, you know, several people have argued that Tarantino has kind of played out his cinematic universe and needs to return back to the Tarantino verse and do stuff there. But the question is will he ever do that? No one knows.
Well, of course, there's that, you know, long rumored project, a movie about the Vega brothers that has kind of been abandoned by the fact that both Travolta and Madsen are too old to reprise those characters. It would definitely have to be a prequel to the stories we've already seen. But going back to this whole idea of, you know, things kind of coming full circle, something that really surprised me, and I've talked about world building and universe building now being a key function, a key tool for these big studios. There were these ads that were created for the European release, and the distributor, what they did is they used one sheet posters for each of the main characters, because, you know, the different colors. No one had ever done that at the time. And now if you look at every major release of every movie with multiple characters or multiple big name stars, that's a go-to thing. That is now a go-to function of the advertising department is, oh, just do character posters. Mm-hmm. And then they, like, every time there's new... God, the Hunger Games? The most recent Hunger Games had like 60 of these motherfuckers.
Oh, yeah. Reservoir Dogs, that was one of the things. They started as imports. and we would import them. And then they became so popular, you could get them in the mall. But they would they made replica UK subway posters. And one of my first apartment was covered in them. So, you know, and they were subway sized posters of all the characters from Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, along with one of their quotes from the movie and the, you know, a big, you know, version of the logo. And, it really was one of those cool things. And yeah, now it's one of those things that you do to introduce audiences to the characters in the movie, to sell the characters as a point of seeing the movie.
And all this to say, Reservoir Dogs is an absolutely brilliant film. It's a film that, again, borrows from everywhere and still manages to find its own voice. And it's Tarantino's, you know, first film. It is the film literally that starts with him speaking. It is a statement film if there ever was one. And it's really interesting to see not only how that film did and how that film was received, but how it started and it influenced so many filmmakers to come, and how the indie boom of the 90s would not have happened, or at least not happened the way that it did, if not for Quentin Tarantino, which makes this an even more interesting subject in the overall history of film.
Yeah. Yeah. It's such an important film, and it's such a good goddamn film. I mean, it really does hold up. If you've not seen it for 10, 20 years, sit down and watch it again and remind yourself why it's so good. Watch it on DVD or Blu-ray. So many of us watched it. It was so weird. So many of us watched it only on VHS. When it came out on DVD, that was the first time many of us had ever seen it widescreen. Oh, and wow. That was just like, holy shit, this is what the rest of the movie looks like.
Oh shit, this is how all movies should be viewed.
Yeah, well, and many of us worked in video stores and tried to convince people of that for years. The DVD's broken. It's cutting off the top and the bottom of my movie.
Oh my god.
I worked in a
video store many years after you did, and I still heard that shit.
Oh yeah.
And I tried to explain to people like this. Look, you watch a movie like, you know, the painting of the Last Supper? Okay. In full screen, Jesus has 10 disciples instead of 12.
I used to pull out AI because and that was the movie that I'd pull out for a while, where I'd pull out AI on VHS and DVD and I'd pop them into two different TVs and I'd play and I'd let them, I'd be okay, look over here. And they're like, yeah, that's the whole movie. And then they look over and they're like, oh, wait, oh my God. They're like, that's what this is. And it's like, yeah. And they're like, oh, well, I'll take the DVD then.
Is that as good for you as it was for me?
And that brings us, of course, to the junk food pairing. And it's very interesting. Cargill never knows what I'm going to pick before we start recording. And yet he referenced exactly why I've picked this in the first place during one of his diatribes. And it is bacon and eggs from a greasy spoon diner.
Fuck yeah.
The world was introduced to Quentin Tarantino via a group of guys sitting around a diner table eating breakfast. Tarantino himself has talked at length about how the nights he spent discussing film with friends in LA diners is what led him to be a filmmaker in the first place. And in many ways, fittingly, that's how junk food cinema got started. I mean, me and this man over here, I can't even count the number of hours we have spent at gyms here in Austin eating breakfast food.
Slugging down coffee. You quoting Parks and Rec.
Yes.
Bring all the bacon.
All the eggs and bacon you have. And just talking about movies, just bullshitting about. That's really the reason we're doing this podcast in the first place.
Yeah.
So
it's cheaper to sit in your house than it is to keep ordering breakfast. And
that's
better
true.
For our waistlines.
That's very true.
But no, we still go to gyms all the time.
All the time.
The goddamn breakfast.
Oh, so good.
Oh, yes. Have you tried the new... The new sausage white cream gravy
jalapeno
sausage cream gravy
Benedict.
It is kind of fucking fantastic.
I saw that on the menu the other day and I was like, oh man, that looks really good.
It is.
No, the 3-egg breakfast with hash browns and crispy bacon. I don't even know why I have to tell these people anymore.
We need to go out and have that now.
Yeah, we're going to have to.
Because it's a limited time, and it's really, once you have it, you're going to be going in for a whole week and getting that goddamn jalapeno sausage cream gravy.
Well, thanks for joining us here on Junk Food Cinema while we accomplish the two things that are at the heart of this show, talking about movies and making ourselves fatter somehow. So I want to remind you once again that you can listen to all episodes of Junk Food Cinema on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter @Junk Food Cinema or like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/ Junk Food Cinema. Cargill, where can people find you on the web?
You can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/massaworm. That's MASSAWYRM. And at twitter.com/massaworm.
Awesome. You can find me on Twitter as well at BryGuySalisbury and on my Facebook page, facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic. You can also find me over at oneofus.net, my home away from home. Lots of podcasts and blogs over there for your geek listening pleasure. And yeah, this has been a fun series.
It's been a very fun series, but they take a biscuit and they cut it in half and put sausage on top and then fried eggs on each of that. And then they top it with jalapeno sausage cream gravy. How can that not be and the fried taters they got that come with it, they're not stuff that they've made before. They've actually got new home fries. It's really kind of fucking fantastic.
So we need to go right now.
We need to go right now and get this.
All right, Ramblers, let's get rambling. Dum 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 d